I find myself among heroes, and it's a particular privilege to address an organization whose commitment to free speech is so consistent that it extends both to principle and to remuneration. The reward is spiritual and the privilege of your company. Did Western civilization survive the 20th century? Is the sound okay? The very fact that this question might reasonably be posed is in itself, of course, alarming, but be not unnecessarily dismayed. The West, in its various incarnations, has felt the end of its own civilization almost from the beginning. We do ourselves and our culture a great disservice, and with the unbecoming hubris of self-portraiture as victims, if we imagine ourselves the unhappiest of souls at the unhappiest of times, or as the last bearers of the Western torch. Imagine the question being posed when Athens fell, when Christian Rome was sacked by barbarians, when Norsemen ravaged settled Europe, when feudal warlords reigned unchecked, when at the end of the first millennium all signs indicated a world out of joint that seemed to presage the end of civilization, when the Black Death left soul and society without mooring. Imagine the question posed by critics of the papacy visiting the decadence and bad faith of 14th century Rome, or by Catholic apologists when they saw Western Christendom rent first in two and then into a multitude of competing sects. Imagine that question posed during the religious civil wars, or indeed during the devastation of the 30 Years' War, when Europe was a charnel house of competing militant creeds and dynastic interests. Imagine the question posed during the Terror, the decades of revolutionary and then Napoleonic wars. Imagine in our century the question posed on the slaughter fields of World War I, or at Auschwitz, or in the Gulag. The West is resilient beyond all seeming possibility, and something gives it that resilience. The West has survived its barbarians without, and more dreadful yet, its own barbarian offspring. If it could outlast Attila the Hun, Julius Streicher, and Mikhail Suslov with nuclear arms, it surely can outlast Michel Foucault, Stanley Fish, and the friends of Bill. I was told to expect a more pessimistic crowd. Okay. At each moment of seeming disillusion, profound voices in rightful lamentation, who analyzed compellingly the depths to which we had fallen, spoke of the almost infinite remove we were from any light, and the loss of something that we never could recover. And yet the West survived. There was something about its mind and its spirit. Greece fell, but its philosophers conquered the minds of those who conquered its soil, and indeed its muses touched consciousness and sensibility wherever its language became accessible. It fell, but when the human bearers of Christian revelation sought a human voice of natural philosophy by which to explain, justify, and elaborate upon their beliefs, They found it almost despite themselves in Greece, in Platonic and Neoplatonic philosophies, later in Aristotle, even in the Greek skeptics. Greece fell, but its mathematics still measures actually and metaphorically the world. It fell, but its natural conceptual categories still organize our understanding of and debates about reality and knowledge. Rome physically fell, but its language became the lingua franca and thus the natural definitional universe of Christendom. Its history became the great drama by which to understand the glory and the baseness of political life. The barbarian tribes believed that they had conquered Rome, but Rome in greater part had conquered them, and their descendants called their realm the Holy Roman Empire, and these words were not, until much later, empty words. When the Norsemen came, learning fled to monasteries, and that learning, and indeed those monasteries, eventually conquered the Norse, whose descendants in Britain founded universities that live to this day. How utterly astonishing. It is the last thing any terrified monk taking desperate shelter in the 8th century ever could have thought. Through natural catastrophe, anarchy, war, and despotisms, the West survived. Its religion teaching not only the sanctity of individual responsibility, but that the greatest of sins was despair, a lesson that each generation needs to relearn afresh, and that conservatives desperately need to relearn today. The 30 Years' War seemed the end of civilization, but its battles now are nearly forgotten, indeed for most of today's students unknown. And what remains of that 17th century? Bacon, Galileo, Descartes, Hobbes, Pascal, Bale, Boyle, Harvey, Huygens, Newton, Locke. Louis XIV is a tourist attraction at Versailles. His wars changed precious little. The conceptual revolution of the West, however, changed a great deal in that same 17th century. It was born of the very dynamics of the West's models of learning, disputation, accounting for appearances, refining inductive and deductive logic, now linked to expanded education and to printing. What happened in the minds of the graduates of Europe's Christian universities changed the human relationship to nature, to knowledge, to charity armed with knowledge, to the rights of inquiry and conscience, and to political and economic life itself. When Galileo was charged with offering an astronomy that contradicted scripture, he replied by citing the ancient fathers of the church themselves, above all Augustine, who had insisted that there was but one truth, that it was consistent, that it shone in nature also, and that no one had the right to tie the faith to what could be proven false in the created natural world. The Christian West kept the traditions of Greek mind alive and of its own debates overthrew the presumptive authority of the past in matters of natural knowledge and its application, believing that we were not cast fatally adrift in this world, but that we could learn new things with the lights of our minds, and that we could alter the sorry scheme of things closer to the heart's desire for knowledge, order, and well-being. It was not Faust who dreamed of occult knowledge that would make him a demigod, but Bacon, who commanded that knowledge proceed from humility and charity, who became the prophet of the great scientific revolution of the West. Louis XIV is a statue. Bacon is a living force wherever the West touches minds. It is odd for any of us at universities that conservatives should question whether Western civilization has survived the 20th century when all of our colleagues on the cultural left define that civilization as a singular hegemony that stands astride the globe. What, after all, is the multiculturalism so ardently but desperately proclaimed in higher education but the belief that there is a hegemonic Western civilization that frames all issues and provides almost all modes of understanding and that somehow must be challenged? For the cultural left, the question is not whether what they see without complexity as Western civilization will survive into the 21st century, but whether anything other than Western civilization will so survive. Might it not be at least in part that we should take heart from their despair, a despair so intense that they are reduced to saving the world from us by doing revolutionary social work in the Ivy League? What, after all, do they mean by the hegemony of the West? It is not physical colonialism and imperialism that concern them anymore, as the moral depredations of these, they forget, concern so many of you and your heroes. No, they see as far more ominous what they term the cultural colonialism and imperialism of the West, a triumphant colonialism of the mind by a civilization that believes in universal categories that transcend its own time and space. The West believes its faiths and values to be accessible to all human souls, its science to be a method by which all human beings everywhere can rise above ignorance, superstition, helplessness, and prejudice. The West believes that there are rights and obligations that belong to humanity as humanity. We despair about our disappearance. The cultural left despairs about our transcendent success. There are profound ironies about the multicultural leftists, so many of which testify precisely to the dynamism and inescapable appeal of precisely that civilization to whose dismemberment they are in theory committed. If we took the multiculturalists at their word, they hold the view that there is no fixed point from which to value or to analyze cultures objectively, which are therefore inherently equal, all cultures judging themselves from perspectives relative to themselves. If this were true, of course, the multiculturalist judgments of the injustice, inequity, and malevolence of Western culture, its racism and sexism compared to the rest of the world, no less, would be self-contradictory of their theory itself. Instead, of course, they sound at their best like biblical prophets calling power to categorical moral duty, or at their worst, like traditional Western social critics who in this case have not thought out either their facts or their logic well. Their self-contradictions betray their inability to escape from the culture they claim so to despise. In their epistemology, their theory of knowledge, they are the third-rate heirs of the Greek skeptics and historians without even knowing to their shame that fact. Their assaults upon dogmatism at their best never rise above the level and subtleties and paradoxes handed down to us by Sextus Empiricus, chronicler and compiler of the Greek skeptical tradition. He was a bestseller in the 16th century and widely translated in the 17th. His writings intellectually delighted European men of letters, including clerics, many of whom embraced him as a tonic antidote to the pride of human reason. Many philosophers modified their metaphysics in the face of such skepticism. The West always has been concerned with the limits of reason and knowledge, the role of received prejudice and custom, the appropriateness or arrogance of its metaphysical conclusions, and with the phenomenon of paradox. Indeed, the West has authored the formal exposition and mental pyrotechnics of such concerns. The heirs of the least subtle forms of that tradition do not even know their parentage, but their inheritance attests to the dynamism, for better or worse, of the Western intellectual dialogue itself. It was the Greeks and their heirs, not any third world critics of post-colonialism, who obsessed so creatively about the role of King Nomos, of received opinion, of education and prejudgment, of the seeming relativity of values and beliefs and taste to time, place, and accident of birth. Montesquieu in the 18th century was so profoundly struck by the malleability of the human condition and by the relativity of what might seem the most foundational aspects of human existence to geography, time, and historical vicissitude. He also understood, however, what our current social constructionists do not see, that as undeniable as that malleability may be, there is a natural reality that underlies conditions and sets limits to it, and that the relationship of human malleability and natural reality is the appropriate subject of deep, objective study. Civilizations, Montesquieu observed, may flourish ephemerally without solving real problems of reciprocity, justice, and virtue, but they cannot survive. Certain forms of human association may persist for as long as terror and despotism coerce them, but there is a real human nature and a set of real human needs, and these will out toward their true ends when that coercion is by chance or struggle lessened. Montesquieu and Enlightenment thinkers in general often are equally loathed by conservatives who believe them excessively relativistic and postmodernists who see them as excessively objective and as lying at the heart of the modern project of evil. In fact, few in the Enlightenment would have disagreed with the observation that Adam Smith made in 1759 about our need to reflect upon, quote, the necessity of justice to the existence of society, end quote. Think on postmodern canon and politics fully to grasp the irony of their proclaimed alienation from Western thought and value. Their ideologies derive not from non-Western culture, but from the debates of the West and the products of its educational legacies. From Marcuse, Gramsci, Marx, Hegel, and Rousseau. From, in short, the debates that the West always has had with itself. Their kaleidoscopic values eventually returned to the West also. They sought sanctuary for the Leninists of Latin America in Christian churches, that most medieval of notions, sanctuary. They campaign against and indeed seek asylum in America for the victims of involuntary female circumcision, citing our notions of legal equality and universal human dignity, not their alleged commitments to the relativity of all human values and cultures. They seek tenure at universities with medieval traditions of what the West called philosophical liberty. They wear ribbons for greater funding of Western medical research into the causes and cures of disease. Hypocrites without self-knowledge will not bring down this civilization unless... unless we join them in its demolition and work even harder than they to do so. So-called multiculturalism and the triumph of self-proclaimed despisers of the West in our institutions of learning and culture is indeed tragic by what it denies our students in the way of positive learning. But these lamentable but insignificant movements will not bring down the edifice of our civilization. They do not even have the courage to present themselves to the world for what they are. The Bolsheviks, after all, did not present themselves as preserving capitalism. As presented to the public, multiculturalism describes itself as inviting the deep study, appreciation, and celebration of a diversity of cultures, removing legitimacy from any and all claims of cultural superiority. Indeed, college cafeterias occasionally have their Korean or African food days, cuisine being, in my view, multiculturalism's strongest suit. In fact, however, the primary true meaning of multiculturalism is quite different. It means precisely the following, but it is unannounced in those catalogs. There is one dominant culture in the West, Greek, Judeo-Christian, and Enlightenment in its sources, the enemy of authentic debate, human freedom, and altruism everywhere, capitalistic, sexist, racist, and Eurocentric, spreading ignorance, injustice, despotic power, and poverty everywhere. One hegemonic culture. Any voice that challenges it, but only those voices that challenge it, are multicultural, that is, progressive enemies of the singular, dominant, satanic culture. That is why neo-Marxism in Africa is multicultural, but Thomas Sowell is not. That is why queer theory attacking the scientific tradition is multicultural, but gay log cabin Republicans are not. That is why the Sandinistas are multicultural, but the Cuban entrepreneurs of Dade County are not. The multiculturalists do not mean the deep study, appreciation, and celebration of evangelical, Protestant, traditionalist, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Black American Pentecostal cultures, or of the gender roles of Orthodox Jewish or Shiite Islamic culture. they do not mean a celebration of any assimilationist immigrant cultures, or do not hold your breath, of white rural southern cultures. They also do not mean the serious study of West African Benin culture or Confucian culture, both requiring linguistic accomplishment and rigorous Western inquiry to achieve understanding. All they mean is the appreciation, celebration, and deep study of those westernized intellectuals who think exactly as they do about the nature and causes of oppression wherever they are found, however non-representative they are of the groups they allegedly represent. They are not multiculturalists. They are Western radicals in the Western radical tradition with the most imperial, dogmatic, and absolutist aspirations of all. Further, they are the beneficiaries of the Western commitment to intellectual debate over coerced intellectual conformity in the Republic of Letters. They are the beneficiaries of our evolved Western tolerance of dissent and extreme heterodoxy. They are the beneficiaries of our tradition from Aristotle's insistence that we overcome all possible arguments against our beliefs, to the medieval insistence upon objections in its formal disputations, to Mill's insistence that beliefs untested by free criticism are no longer truly alive. They are beneficiaries of the Western evolved tradition that we must consider radical dissent, of our own philosophical pluralism, and indeed of its constant extension. But as they deny to others those values of which they are themselves beneficiaries, they will lose by their own hypocrisy and arrogance any legitimate claim upon the protections that these values offer, and there will be a day of reckoning. It may take time, but it truly is as simple as that. They are here by our forbearance. The current barbarians within also remind us that the West is, again and again, the author of its own worst follies and abuses, compared to which most postmodernists pale into virtual insignificance. We are the authors of our own religious wars and persecutions, our own enthusiastical superstitions, our own conquests of lands and peoples over which and whom we had no rights, our own ultimate nightmares of national or Leninist socialism, which drowned our world in blood unimaginable in any century but the 20th, and which truly threatened to bring this civilization to an awful end. We have had the will, however, to learn from depravity and from reality, and to bear ultimate witness to the higher sides of our being. What civilization ever has engaged in more searing analysis and soul searching than our own, of its own sins? Having defeated the National Socialists and the Communists within, the bearers of the best of this civilization have reason for a moment, at least, of optimistic pride. What often denies us both optimism and pride, however, is the very stringency of our self-judgment untempered by historical realism. It is a dangerous intellectual error to imagine that goodness, wisdom, order, justice, peace, freedom, legal equality, mutual forbearance, and kindness are the default state of things in human affairs, and that it is malice, folly, disorder, war, coercion, legal inequality, murderous intolerance, and cruelty that stand in need of historical explanation. The West, in theory, always has understood that man has a lower side to which he is drawn, that man is a wolf to man, and that we are governed more by prejudice and passion than by the rational capacity of our minds. The West always had understood that knowledge, including moral knowledge, is a hard-won acquisition, and its application even harder. If that is so, however, then we err grievously in our assumptions of what it is that requires particular explanation in the world. We understand the defaults. What should astonish us is the ability in this civilization to change them. Rousseau and the postmodernists have it all completely wrong in this domain. It is not aversion to difference that requires historical explanation. Aversion to difference is the human condition. Rather, it is the West's partial but breathtaking ability to overcome tribalism and exclusion by externality that demands explanation, above all in the singular American accomplishment. It is not the injustice of difference in America that requires historical explanation, as if this were the odd phenomenon of human affairs. That injustice indeed requires reflection, lest we ever lose sight of human moral weakness in general and of our own malice in particular. But historically, it is the existence and agency of Western values by which that injustice has been and is being progressively overcome that truly should excite our study, curiosity, and awe. Anti-Semitism is not surprising. The opening of Christian America to Jews is what should amaze. Racial aversion and injustice are not, alas, surprising. The 14th Amendment and its gradual implementation are what should astonish. It is not the abuse of power that demands explanation. That is the West, that is the human condition, but rather the Western rule of law. It is not coerced religious conformity that should leave us wondering, but the forging of values and institutions of religious toleration. Most dramatically, of course, it is not slavery that requires explanation. Slavery is one of the most universal of all human institutions, but rather the values and agency by which the West identified slavery as an evil and astonishment of astonishments abolished it. Finally, it is not relative pockets of poverty in the West that should occasion our wonder. We used to have a different name for almost infinitely worse absolute levels of poverty. It was called the human condition. Ethics and liberties that created such prosperity that we even notice such poverty at all, let alone believe that it is rare and eradicable. we are surprised in a failure of intellectual analysis by all of the wrong things, and we lose our wonder at the accomplishment and aspirations of our civilization as a tragic result. Depravity should never startle us. Rather, it is the identification and naming of depravity that should amaze us, and the attempt, frequently successful, to contain it should fill us with awe. That attempt, indeed, has been so successful in the West relative to the human condition that the other world fantasized by the multiculturalists seeks entrance again and again at our doors. I see the alleged victims of Western civilization hopefully seeking entrance to it. I do not see its intellectual despisers and despoilers beating down the doors of the cultures they claim or claimed to celebrate and find equal. Leave Harvard for Sierra Leone, MIT for the Khmer Rouge's Kampuchea or contemporary Vietnam, gender feminists escaping the oppression of the West, for Kenya, Guatemala, Cuba, Afghanistan, India, or the territories of the Inuits, I think not. Some might argue that there is a prosperity that draws, but it would be odd to hear the multiculturalists argue that. Odd for so many to have been willing to die merely for the prosperity of their neighbors, and odd to think that the prosperity of the West does not reflect the fruits in productivity of its values, its freedoms, its notions of individual liberty and responsibility, its faiths, its institutions of law and legal equality, its commitment to reciprocity, and its intellectual realism. Let me talk a moment about that latter trait of the West, its intellectual, its philosophical realism. While various extreme epistemological and ontological skepticisms and various radical irrationalisms have flourished, sometimes with brilliance and profundity in our history, Western civilization always has had at its core a belief that there is a reality independent of our wishes for and ideas of it, that natural knowledge of that reality is possible, indeed indispensable to human dignity, and that such knowledge must be acquired through a discipline of the will and mind, and that central to that discipline is the Western compact with reason. The West has willed, in theory, to reduce the chaos of the world to natural coherence as much as possible by the powers of the mind. When some Christian voices condemn such efforts as impious, the great doctors of the church proclaim such efforts indispensable to a coherence on which even a human understanding of the faith depended. The Christian universities of the West began higher education in philosophy, and to reason badly or against straw men was always deemed a grave error. The Greek principle of self-contradiction is the touchstone of error, and its avoidance as the touchstone of truth is the formal expression of a Western commitment to reason that we always have believed separated us from madmen and beasts. To live with self-contradiction was not merely to fail in introduction to philosophy. It was to be less than human, less than sane. Induction from experience had a logic, and the exploration of that logic was one of the great and ultimately triumphant pursuits of the Western mind. the Christian universities of Europe did not believe emphatically that their enemy was the logic of deduction and induction applied to a knowable natural reality. They believed that philosophy was the handmaiden of faith, and while it was not necessary to salvation, it was necessary to a coherent natural understanding of the creed and to full human dignity. It was not surprising, thus, that those Christian universities were so much more dynamic and productive of intellectual innovation that their caricaturists, either their rebellious sons or their later historians, ever allowed. The great minds whom we associate with the conceptual revolutions of the 17th and 18th centuries were almost all educated by these universities and remained true to the call to know an independent reality by means of human inquiry and coherent reason. There were many radical ruptures in the history of certain disciplines in the West. There was no radical rupture with the Western compact with reality and reason. It is the compact that led to a civilization in which religion itself led the self-scrutiny against superstition that gave rebirth to critical scholarship and ultimately to a tolerated heterodoxy that was permitted to question the West's religion itself. A civilization in which the irrational could appeal with ultimate, in which those faced with the irrational could appeal with ultimate success to the rational. A civilization in which belief in learning as a constant self-correction, whose goal was the understanding of a reality independent of self, led to the sciences that have changed the entire human relationship to nature, society, and economics, and our sense of human possibilities tempered by our sense of human nature. The fruits of that civilization have been an unprecedented ability to modify the remediable causes of human suffering, to give great agency to utility and charity alike, to give each individual a degree of choice and freedom unparalleled in all of human history, to offer a means of overcoming the station in life to which one was born by the effort of one's labor, mind, and will. With merely these fruits alone, the West still might have been a parochial civilization, closed, xenophobic, only conquering. And there have been those who wished and worked for that model of the West. But the drama is that this civilization of the West, for all its faults and sins, believed that its values and knowledge were not parochial, but universal, the birthright of every human life and soul. It believed in the final analysis that its values transcended its geographical space. To believe that this is a source of suffering, not hope in the world, as the 20th century ends, is to break the compact with reality, with reason, and with the logic of inductive inference. Let the inhabitants of the world take or leave that offering. We have come by our own dynamic to treasure voluntary, not coerced exchange. But to the extent that it survives, the hope of the world survives to eradicate unnecessary suffering, to speak a language of human dignity, responsibility, and rights linked to a common reality. To the extent that Western civilization survives, there endures the means to minimize the depredations of the irrational, the unexamined, the merely prejudicial in our lives, with the possibility of applying that knowledge for good in the world in which we find ourselves. Has that civilization survived? That is to ask, has a human relationship to the world based on the assumption of a knowable reality, reason, and transcendent values of human dignity survived? Has a will to know oneself and the world objectively survived? Has a recognition of human depravity and the need to limit the power of men over men survived? It is also to ask if human beings observing the fruits of different ways of being human find foundational importance in the way of the West. I do not think that free men and women will abandon that hard-won shelter from chaos, ignorance, parochial tribalism, irrationalism, and ultimately helplessness. There is a reality principle. The world does operate by laws and ways independent of human will. Knowledge and the belief that such knowledge are ultimately universal are our only means of coexisting with that reality. Multiculturalism, if analyzed properly, does not mean what it says, and if taken at its word, is a visible hell where few sane souls ever would enter of their own accord. Popular culture appalls conservatives for the same reason that pockets of poverty so appall the left. What had been the human condition, now, given the triumph of civilization, is visible as something that shocks one's sensibilities. The Christians of the late Roman Empire preserved and sustained the bloody circuses and games of the Colosseum, the popular entertainments of medieval and early modern Europe would turn your heads. I think that we can live with Jerry Springer in exchange. If we have the will to fight for decent culture by example and moral criticism, if we have the will to fight with confidence the new barbarians in our midst, the future does belong to realism, critical mind, reason, notions of rights and responsibilities that transcend mere time and place, and to the bountiful fruits of those extraordinary commitments. There is work to be done, and you are doing it, to preserve the fruits in the late 20th century of this Western civilization and to debate with our opponents upon the terrain of the real. After generations in which the great defenders of the humane and just consequences of the allocation of capital by free markets rather than central planners have remained either unexplored, marginalized, or dismissed as absurd by most American intellectuals, most students simply never have heard of Mises or Hayek or Friedman. After generations, when the lionized intellectuals dreamed about and debated how to make the inevitable transition from unproductive capitalism to the cornucopia of central planning. After at least a generation in which Western academics have viewed the West as the great obstacle to justice and peace and held it in contempt as a set of ideals, after all these sad things, the seeming triumph of the West, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and of Marxist theory at all places but Western universities. Unless we win the war of ideas, these phenomena will be understood and taught by Western intellectuals merely as the self-correction that showed how absurd Western fears were from the start, or as simply the economic collapse of communists who in various ways betrayed their ideals or failed to temper them with adequate pragmatism. Recall even the early 1980s, the romanticization of the kleptomaniacal and anti-democratic Castroite Sandinistas, or even the homicidal megalomaniac Mengistu of Ethiopia. The demonization of Ronald Reagan and the mockery of his description of the Soviet Union as the evil empire and of communism as a vision that would end on the dustbin of history. If only the cultural left bears witness, all of that will be rewritten, forgotten, indirectly justified, and incorporated into a worldview that still teaches students that the West is empire and the rest of the world its victim. Who will tell the tale most compellingly then? Those of us who knew, or those who were plunged into blindness and folly? Cognitive dissonance is an astonishing phenomenon, and on the left it prevents the truth from being told. So let us be clear about 1988 and beyond, and whatever our own disagreements, let us bear witness now to realism, reason, and shared values against the voices of irreality and unreason. The following things are obvious, and they cannot be taught enough. One, the most murderous regime in all of human history, the Bolsheviks in power, has fallen. Its agents were guilty of irredeemable crimes against humanity, and its apologists should do penance for the remainder of their lives. Its apologists, whatever their intentions, were warriors for human misery and slavery. The most that can be said of communism's favor, and everyone must know it, is that it was capable of building, by means of slave labor and terror, a simulacrum of Gary, Indiana, once, and minus the good stuff, and without the means of maintenance or repair. Our students do not understand that. Two, free markets create the means of prosperity and diverse social options and are a precondition of human individuation and freedom. Regimes of central planning create poverty and bring forth ineluctable developments toward totalitarianism and agencies of the worst abuses of power. Dynamic free market democracies have altered the entire human conception of freedom and dignity. The entire socialist experiment ended in stasis, ethnic hatreds, the absence of even the minimal preconditions of economic, social, and political renewal, and in categorical contempt for both individuation and minority rights. On the whole, however, to say the least, Western intellectuals do not revel in or celebrate these triumphs or this knowledge. The indifference has been extraordinary. Where is the celebration and where is the accounting? Ask any American high school or college student to number Hitler's or Christopher Columbus's victims. He will answer for both in the tens of millions. Ask him to number Stalin's victims. If my experience is typical, he will answer in the thousands. Such is their education even now. The absence of engagement and accounting on the left is understandable. Convinced that the West has been the agent of artificial relationships of dominance and subservience, left intellectuals have little interest an objective analysis of the manifest data about free markets or the conditions of life and death under the Bolsheviks and their heirs, or the confirmation and disconfirmation of various theories in the outcome of markets and planning in the 20th century. Less obvious, but equally striking in some ways, has been the absence of celebration on the intellectual right. The most dangerous, barbaric threat from within, no less, of the late 20th century, the European communist threat, military and ideological, is over. And sadly, one sees already on the right a certain nostalgia for the good old days when everything and enemies were clear. Well, three things are clear, ladies and gentlemen. The cruelest regime in the history of mankind has fallen. The model of free markets and accountable governments has at least a chance of being the wave of the human future. And we have achieved, by the sacrifice of wealth and at times our lives and our children's lives, the possibility of a humane future. How extraordinary that there should not be, that these should not be, the cause of at least some Jeroboams of champagne amid the Jeremiads of complaint. Has Western civilization survived its principle of reality justified and intact? Yes, indeed. The demand for perfection, ladies and gentlemen, is antinomian, illogical, and empirically absurd. The triumph of the West is flawed but real. My friends, let us celebrate. Thank you.